this is an exclusive episode, Matt, at least for now.
Okay.
Rough topic. This is Pill Pod on Immanuel Kant. Don't worry, it's not a bad word in Britain.
It means bum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the most famous Russian philosopher, probably.
Russian?
He was born in Kaliningrad.
Yeah, I know. Well, Konigsberg at the time, is that right?
Yeah.
Konigsberg, Prussia.
Allegedly, he never went more than 100 miles from the city, so.
Yeah, so our episode on Nietzsche was about the world's most successful incel, and this is our world's most successful volcel.
did Kant do well with the women? I don't know.
No, he's unmarried.
I thought he died childless.
Apparently, he had some really big parties that people liked. I've heard that. Like, he's supposed to be quite a social dude in Konigsberg, and he'd have like these big drunken events that went late into the night. But they were very rule oriented. He was like, "Okay, you come, and we have dinner at this hour, and then we have conversation between this and that, and then we end it with a period of joking because it's important for everyone to end with mirth."
And you have to go home by 8 o'clock.
If Nietzsche's mind is what happens when you don't get sex and want it, then Kant's critique of pure reason is what happens when you don't even want to get laid and you just have free time.
Yeah, you're just happy walking around. All those legends, people used to set their watch to Kant's appearances during his routines every day. He's very methodical.
Yeah. He also did do like a voluntary isolation that would probably strike people as odd in the day, and in our COVID time, a lot of people would be offended by it because allegedly, like for the 11 years where he was writing the Critique of Pure Reason, he just like fucking peaced and wouldn't talk to anyone. And his friends would write him letters being like, "Yo, so aren't you going to come out again? We want to see you." And he'd be like, "I appreciate your concern, but fuck off." Then he released his book and became more social again, but...
This is extremely common. Descartes did it. So did Hobbes. A lot of good philosophy comes out of exile or isolation.
Yeah. Which, as we talked about in our last episode, is not really possible in a neoliberal context. I think, Matt, you were talking about how could you imagine if you just ask your department, you're like, "I'm going to take like 5 years off and write my magnum opus."
I don't think they would fucking tell me. I don't think they'd be happy if I said I needed 5 weeks. Yeah.
I guess that's what sabbatical is for.
Yeah, you go stay in the mountains and write your thesis or whatever you're working on.
Well, there's some joke to be made here. I don't know if I can make it, but time is not synthesized itself as a concept, but it's the possibility for synthesizing concepts. So there's a slippage of terms to be discussed between the concept of time and his time of isolation in order to write the book of Critique of Pure Reason, which I think we're focusing on today, yeah?
Yeah, and I've also had the time of my life discussing that in many different contexts, so let's get to it.
I can't say the same, and that's our only Kant.
It's going to be like the first of like the wave of bad puns to come.
Oh, no. Okay, so we're going to try to do this.
This is the dad joke episode.
It would be super boring, and we're going to try to make it as light as possible, but not... sacrifice any of the actual theory, but not use all the terms that he uses, like all the 12 or the synthetic a priori or quality, quantity, modality, etc., etc. So try to not do it terminologically, but bring out still the importance of Kant and what's been called the Copernican shift in philosophy.
Mm-hmm. What he called his own philosophy.
Did he call Copernican. It that?
He called it he compared it to what Copernicus
pretty
was
ballsy
doing, what Copernicus did. He had a pretty high opinion of what he was doing.
Rightfully so, though. I mean, like, my general feeling is that I'm willing to tolerate ego in proportion to accomplishment, right? So if you're going to compare yourself to Copernicus, you better pull off something that's pretty impressive. And to Kant's credit, the Critique of Pure Reason is pretty fucking impressive. I don't know if I would quite compare it to Copernicus, but it's up there, you know.
So does anybody want to take a stab at kind of the problem he was faced with at the time in philosophy, in epistemology, and metaphysics that I think he's trying to move past, like the main project?
Well, he's trying to get to the basis of what metaphysics and all those things are. What is knowledge, and what does it mean to have knowledge of things?
Well, I'd say the way to introduce that project is to talk about Hume's skepticism, because that is what Kant is ultimately trying to overcome. So, for example, skepticism became huge in the century before Kant, with people like Montaigne. And also the rediscovery of ancient, like, skeptical work, like what Sextus Empiricus and some of those guys, and it was like the mode of philosophy until Descartes. Descartes tried to put a backstop to that skepticism, right? So we know Descartes did his skeptical method. You know, what if my senses are deceiving me? What if all my judgments are untrue? What if I'm dreaming? And he said, like, the first firm thing, the backstop to that skeptical slide is the cogito, the I think. Like, whatever I doubt, I'm conscious of thinking that I'm doubting something, therefore I think, therefore I am. But with Hume, he kind of overcomes that backstop and enacts a more radical skepticism, and he casts doubt on the possibility of any kind of metaphysical knowledge at all. And a lot of people were shocked by this. Like, Hume's book, The Treatise on Human Nature, he's famously said it fell deadborn from the press. But after him, it became huge, and a lot of people were sort of really, really hated it, but also respected it. And Kant was one of those people who was deeply sort of conflicted about Hume and his accomplishments, but also wanted to move past them and bring metaphysics back. Which is why,
say, like, it was the underground sensation of, like, the 18th century, right? Nobody knew about it, but gradually word of mouth began, and then one day Hume showed up, and he was a celebrity, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think didn't Kant once say that Hume awoke him from his, like, Leibnizian slumber or something like that?
Dogmatic slumber, yeah. But Leibniz would be one of the dogmatic metaphysicians that he was talking about, right? Because metaphysics is never going to be the same after Hume, so it has to be a critical metaphysics now. It can't just be a dogmatic metaphysics where we start from first principles or axioms or however the rationalists liked to do it.
So Kant is trying to rescue the possibility of knowledge, and he's very concerned with this distinction between what we can know and what we know we don't know.
What we can't know?
Oh, no. Please, no.
Well, this is why I framed it somewhat different way, because I agree absolutely that, like, Hume and Descartes were vital predecessors. You can find a lot of what Kant says in them, right? But what was unique is the kind of systematic way that Kant presents this, and the kind of way that he spins off so many different conclusions from this: moral conclusions, aesthetic conclusions, religious conclusions, political conclusions, conclusions about international law, you name it, right? But I think that the kind of fundamental thing that I take away from this whole project is, if you look at classical metaphysics, the kind of metaphysics people like Deleuze, for instance, wants to return to, there's this kind of sense that any limits that we apprehend are inbuilt in reality itself, right? And we have the possibility of going beyond that to apprehend some kind of higher reality that exists in the eternal worm of the forms, or an understanding of God's plan, or in a Platonic chain of being, or whatever it happens to be. And what I think Kant's Copernican re-evolution really amounts to is by saying, no, the kind of limitations you're apprehending aren't just limitations in the kind of reality we inhabit that can consequently be transcended through effort or spirituality, right? They're inbuilt into the structure of the human mind. So any effort that you engage in to try to exceed these limitations is just going to cast you into some kind of transcendental illusion, right? And one of the things that he says that I think is quite brilliant is, he says, if you think about the history of a lot of political communities, so much of what we believe is dependent on transcendental illusion, right? Our beliefs about the meaning of life, our belief about the existence of God, the belief about why there's something instead of nothing at all. And he says we can have no knowledge of this, actually, right? Which is why he is the great destroyer.
The sort of the common narrative that you hear, very crude and very incorrect, but you hear it, is that the Enlightenment was trying to ground things in reason rather than in faith, not in God, but in, like, thinking and human rationality, which is very problematic. But you can see that he's very opposed to dogma. So in his age, he's revolutionary for saying we can't take anything on authority, but what we can do is observe our own process of thinking, which has been an occupation of philosophy since him, saying, I can't know how I think or the mechanisms that go into thought, but I can look at the thoughts that I have and then deduce from that what the fundamental aspects, the irreducible concepts of thought actually are. Even if I don't have true knowledge of their cause, I can know their effects, and their effects can lead me to true knowledge versus ignorance.